This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Metatrex, Trek FM's brand new show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me for the first time is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be talking about the free will and determinism debate and how this philosophical issue is raised and addressed in various places in the Star Trek universe. Well, Mike, here we are. It's been quite a few months of prep work to get us ready for episode one, and we've done a couple of trial runs, and now here we are, ready to go for the first time, episode one of our new podcast. I couldn't be more excited.
It's very exciting. In fact, I saw this bottle of champagne floating out in space. It was going to collide with the starship, so I beamed it into the studio here. I thought it would be appropriate for us to christen the new show, Metatrex. Star Trek Philosophy Podcast.
Very nice. Nice reference there. You know, I couldn't be more excited. I think, for the listeners who are listening to us for the very first time, I think one thing that I can just put out there as a blanket statement is that the Trek FM hosts make this look easy. You know, it's taken months and months of prep work to get us to this point. We have a bunch of people to thank at the end of the show. But after all these weeks and months and manpower of getting a new show ready to go for the network, here we are ready to go for the first time. So, you know, thanks to everyone who's helped us get on the air. And we'll thank some people by name at the end of the show. But we couldn't be more excited. I thought we could spend a few minutes introducing ourselves and introducing the new show. This show, Metatrex, is going to be about Star Trek and philosophy, and as such, I think it'll be a little different than the other shows on the network. I thought we could start off by just introducing ourselves and our backgrounds. Mike, why don't you lead us off? Just tell us a little bit about who you are and your background and interests and how we came to be paired up on Trek FM.
Sure. Of course, my name is Mike Morrison. I reside in the Dallas, Texas area. You know, Zachary, for me, it all began with the original series. I've been a lifelong fan since my childhood in the early 1970s. In 1980, I bought a book at the middle school book fair where I went to school, Pleasance County Middle School. Little bit of pocket money that I had at the time. It was a book of quotes and ideas from Star Trek, being a Trekkie. It just seemed natural to me. The book was called Star Trek Speaks. And in the introduction of the book, the editors talk about Roddenberry's philosophy. There's a segment near the end which reads, Roddenberry was able to use Star Trek effectively as a means of expression for his personal philosophy. Sometimes he was serious and dealt with war, racial prejudice, even death. Other times he allowed his childlike wonder and awe of things around him to creep into weekly episodes, marveling at the universe or poking fun at the human creature. It's because of this aspect of Star Trek, its dramatization of people the way they really are, that the program has remained powerful and relevant, its timeless thoughts speaking perhaps more loudly and clearly today than ever before. So that's what it's really all about for me. Star Trek is this great science fiction. Yeah, absolutely. But it's so much more. It's a study of the human condition, and that's what I want this podcast to celebrate, the human condition through the lens of Star Trek. How about you, Zach?
I feel really similar to you. I'm a lifelong Star Trek fan, like a lot of people listening to the podcast. And I really think this is going to sound like it could be an overstatement, but this is really really true for me that Star Trek kind of prepped my young mind for an interest in philosophy. I'm a professional philosopher, so to speak. I used to teach philosophy at a community college, and I lectured at UC Santa Cruz for a while in philosophy while I was working on my dissertation in philosophy. And even now, I work in education publishing, writing and programming online homework assignments for college logic and philosophy courses. So, you know, as a professional philosopher, of course, naturally, my interests in Star Trek are almost always philosophical. Every time I watch Star Trek or talk about Star Trek with a friend or here on a podcast, my mind is almost always going towards the philosophical issues and distinctions and ways in which the Star Trek brings this rich conceptual abstract philosophy to life for me. Months ago, when I was planning out this show, I've been listening to Trek FM now for probably creeping up on a year. And some time ago, my mind started to hatch this idea that, you know, I really would like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy a lot more. I feel like I've always struggled to find people to talk about Star Trek with, and I've struggled to find people to talk about philosophy with. And here on Trek FM, there's no shortage of people to talk about Star Trek and happily Star Trek and philosophy. So I started to hatch this idea for a new show on the network. And you know, after talking with Christopher Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM, putting some ideas together and passing ideas back and forth and comparing notes and meeting new people, we started to formulate the idea for this show, and we spent the last several months refining and honing it into an idea. And here we are, finally doing episode one after months and months of planning this show. So I couldn't be more excited. You know, this show speaks to the heart of who I am and what I'm interested in when I think about Star Trek and watch Star Trek, the types of discussions I want to have. And, you know, where will this show go? I really don't have any idea. You know, there's hundreds of philosophical topics and issues that we can focus on. We can focus on philosophical threads in any of the Star Trek episodes and movies. But I really want to focus on the intersection or the marriage of abstract and sort of intellectual academic philosophy and how Star Trek brings those abstract ideas to life. I think we would be doing our listeners a disservice if we were so esoteric that we didn't talk about Star Trek. And we could focus just on Star Trek so much that we don't talk about the ideas behind Star Trek. So I'm hoping that we can just find this perfect intersection of using Star Trek to talk about philosophy as if we were sort of teaching philosophy solely with Star Trek and not really focusing on the history of philosophy so much, but really teaching people to think philosophically through Star Trek. It's a fascinating project for me.
Absolutely. I feel the same way and echo a lot of what you said regarding your personal thoughts and ideas. I think it's important to mention to our listeners that you and I actually met on, I believe it was the second Patrons Roundtable.
That's right. It was really only a few months ago. What was that, 2 or 3 months ago now? And you and I clearly developed a rapport and have similar ways of thinking about Star Trek and similar interests in the connections between Star Trek and philosophy and theology and sociology and psychology and all of these meta issues. In fact, we should explain that's the name of the show, right? Meta is literally the Greek word for beyond. And I should channel Chris here for beyond. Exactly. So we should when we announce our show, we should say something like meta, as if it were Star Trek Beyond. It doesn't really work. I can't, of course, I'm not Chris, so I can't bring that to life. But meta means beyond.
There's only one Chris.
And so, my hope is that we can use this show to talk about these deeper meta issues in Star Trek, you know, the philosophy and the psychology and the sociology. And of course, much of the discussion is going to be based in philosophy and theology and whatnot, given our interests. But I want to give ourselves the freedom to cover any of these academic topics that are sort of not purely about Star Trek, but they're these deeper abstract intellectual issues raised by Star Trek.
Absolutely. So, Zachary, do you want to go ahead and introduce the topic of today's inaugural MetaTrex to our listeners?
Absolutely. And as I was thinking about what we might try to cover for our first episode, I wanted to try to pick a topic that is really accessible, that people can access and understand and will enjoy thinking about right off the bat, you know? And the thing that came to mind for me is free will and determinism. It's always been one of my favorite philosophical issues. I think everyone has some experience thinking about this. You know, they wonder if their life is controlled by forces outside their control, or whether they're really in control of their own destiny. Do they really have free will or personal agency? I think this comes up every time life starts to feel a little out of control for a lot of people. So I think everyone has some experience with this. And happily, as I was thinking thinking through, I started thinking about the topic, free will and determinism, and looking for examples in the Star Trek universe, I found it was really easy to find examples of different types of theories and approaches to this topic right inside the Star Trek universe. So given that, I thought we could just start by making a couple of distinctions between different views on this topic, and then go looking for examples, see what kind of examples we can find in the Star Trek universe, and see if we can really illuminate this topic using nothing but Star Trek examples.
Perfect. Yeah, and Zachary, there are three possible positions that we can take here. You know, the first one is going to be, as you mentioned, free will. And that is the idea that some actions are freely chosen, that we have a personal agency. And we'll talk more about that, I think, in the next episode. And then we have hard determinism, or what is called incompatibilism. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I should actually say that that we plan to make this a two-part episode. Really, this topic is on free will and determinism, and there's no way we're going to be able to cover all of that in an hour or so. So we plan to talk mainly about determinism today, and we'll pick up some of the threads on free will in part two of this discussion, which we'll do next week. But before we do that, let's talk about the basic terminology. You mentioned free will already, and I want to say that, you know, as you start thinking about free will, it's important to ask the question about why we care about free will. And as I think about free will, there's two main things that come to mind. One is, you know, we tend to hold people responsible for their actions, right? We praise them and we blame them. We hold them legally responsible for their actions in criminal cases and whatnot. And generally, we really only feel justified holding people responsible for their actions if those actions are freely chosen. And also, free will is very much tied to our personal identity. You know, as a person, my ability to choose my interests and what I'm going to dedicate my life to, what I study in school or what career I pursue, or whether I decide to do a podcast or some other interest, those are so tied to my personal identity. It's hard to imagine what a human life would be like, a human personal identity, without some sense of being able to freely choose those kinds of things. So free will is really ingrained with our sense of moral responsibility and our sense of personal identity. And that's the motivating factor, I think, for why we care about this. If we don't have free will, then maybe we're not justified in holding people responsible for their actions. Maybe we would lose some important sense of our personal identity. So we have some really deep-seated vested interest in hanging on to this notion of free will. But of course, that doesn't make it philosophically true, right? So the other position is what's called hard determinism. And hard determinism is also called incompatibilism. It's this idea that human actions, and when I say human, I mean not necessarily human. Of course, we're in the Star Trek universe, right? So if we're going to use Star Trek to talk about free will and determinism, we're not just talking about humans. We're talking about alien life forms and artificial life forms and whatnot. But we're going to kind of use human as a placeholder. That human actions are determined by prior causes that are outside of your control. So if all of your actions that look like they're freely chosen are actually necessitated or caused by things that are outside of your control, then that really looks like we don't have free will. And that's why the position is called incompatibilism, this idea that free will and determinism are just radically incompatible with each other. And if determinism ends up being true, that our actions are determined by things outside our control, then we just outright don't have free will, no matter how much it seems like we do when we make a choice. So that's the second position, hard determinism. Mike, why don't you tell us about the third position, soft determinism, or what's called compatibilism.
Sure. One point I want to make about hard determinism: hard determinists like B.F. Skinner would really reject the idea of free will. You know, Skinner believed that ideas like motivation and personal agency only really disguise the causal factors that influence human behavior. And, you know, we'll talk specifically about the various types of determinism tonight and how we see them presented in the Star Trek universe. But yes, soft determinism or compatibilism is the idea that some of our actions can be both free choices but also determined at the same time by various causal factors like physical factors, biological factors, psychological factors. You know, that these causal factors can also influence behavior.
Yeah, it's an interesting position. And I remember when I was first learning about free will and determinism back in college, and it always struck me as something of a contradiction, right? If our actions are fully determined, in what sense can they be free at the same time? And interestingly enough, that's probably the most popular philosophical position on this topic in recent years. And we're not really going to go into free will or compatibilism so much this week, but it's important to have these in the background of your mind. You know, as we start thinking through different types of deterministic causal factors that could explain human behavior or any of the behavior you see in the Star Trek universe, you know, what possible room is there left over for free will? And is there a way to preserve some sense of free will even given all of those causal factors? And I think that's the motivation behind that third position. You know, sort of accepting that those deterministic factors are still true, but still trying to give some substantive sense of free will given all of them. So those are the three main positions, and we did just want to get them out of the way. And again, we want to use Star Trek to talk about these topics, but it's important to have a sense of what the overall distinctions and positions are. So as we're talking about free will and determinism, really all positions that you can come up with boil down into one of these three categories. Either there's some sort of radical sense of free will that is contrary to deterministic factors, or human actions are totally constrained by deterministic factors that we're going to spell out here in a minute. Or they're compatible in some way and they're not really a contradiction. And you can really take any position you want in this debate and squeeze it into one of these three overall positions. So given that, Mike, I thought what we could do today for our first episode is just do the first half of this discussion. Let's spend, you know, 40 minutes or so talking through a bunch of different examples of determinism in the Star Trek universe. And then for our next discussion, part two of this discussion next week, we can look at, you know, the flip side of the coin. Is there any room for free will and free will given those deterministic factors, given these challenges to free will? And how is this presented in the Star Trek universe? What kinds of examples come up where causal factors are being juxtaposed with actions that look like they're sort of radically free inside the Star Trek narratives? How does that sound for a way to proceed?
That sounds great. And Zachary, I do want to say, I hope that our listeners will weigh in as well and give us some feedback as we discuss these various causal factors. If you've got thoughts about how they're presented in the Star Trek universe, let's continue the discussion and give us some feedback. Let us know what your thoughts are as well.
Absolutely. The last thing we want to be to our listeners is talking heads talking about philosophy for an hour, right? This is an ongoing discussion in the history of philosophy. This is an ongoing discussion here on Trek FM as we think about the intersection of Star Trek and philosophy. We want to open the discussion up. So by no means do we ever think that our two cents on the topics are the last word. You know, find us on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners group. Find us on Twitter and, you know, keep the conversation going. Feel free to chime in. We welcome it and encourage it, and we would love to hear what everyone has to say on these topics. Without a doubt, people will make topics that are more important than I'm going to make tonight.
Indeed. All right, Zachary, let's talk about biological determinism. You know, to what extent is our behavior determined by our genes, our genetics?
Yeah, the first type of determinism that came to mind as I was thinking about determinism is this idea of biological determinism. The idea that human behavior, again, or androids or aliens in Star Trek, to what extent is their behavior determined by their biology, their genes or their genetic makeup or neuroscience of their brain, anything biological? And as I was thinking this through, I actually found it really difficult to find examples of biological determinism in Star Trek. You can think of examples maybe like the augments, you know, that are their behavior is you know, programmed in by their genes. But the thing that came to my mind are artificial life forms like Data or the Doctor. Even though, you know, this is called biological determinism and those aren't strictly biological beings, the interesting question for those beings is to what extent their behavior is controlled or determined by their programming, right? The algorithms and the rules that make up their programs and their reactions. In the case of Data, you know, the behavior of his neural net, does that fully determine his possible suite of actions, or is Data in some way able to overcome the programming and the behavior of his neural net and become sort of sentient and autonomous and be able to choose his path in a way that's not just determined by his programming? You can kind of say, you know, the you can kind of phrase it in terms of the question of whether Data is more than the sum of his parts or whether the Doctor is more than the sum of his programming. And of course, it's put that way in several discussions inside of Star Trek, right? But, you know, I think what's interesting about those characters for me is that they're metaphors, they're stand-ins for us, right? You can ask the same question about human behavior. To what extent are my natural inclinations and reactions and instincts biologically programmed in by my genetic makeup or my ancestral history or anything biological like that. So biological determinism, this idea that maybe your actions are determined by lower level biological factors.
Absolutely. And of course, we all know that Data is fully programmed, fully functional, and he is programmed with multiple techniques.
That's right. Absolutely.
I think about the Jem'Hadar in DS9.
Yeah. That wasn't quite what I had in mind, but
yeah. I think about the Jem'Hadar in DS9. They were genetically programmed super soldiers. Everything about their genetic engineering.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting about the Jem'Hadar is, you know, there are several cases in Deep Space Nine where the Jem'Hadar, you know, a particular Jem'Hadar soldier gets sort of aware of the fact that they've been programmed. You know, they know their role, they know how they got there, they know that they were bred, and yet those biological factors that are programmed into them, that are deeply ingrained genetically, are sort of overriding factors, right? No matter how much they become self-aware, they just can't seem to overcome this biological drive that has been intentionally programmed in and bred into them by the founders.
Yeah, including their addiction to Ketracel White, which was I think, at least for me, one of those, you know, deterministic factors, one of those causal factors that influenced their behavior. So even that was genetically programmed into them in order to ensure their loyalty to the founders. So I think in every way, they're a pretty good example of biological determinism. Odo would be another good example. You know, his genetic drive to join the Changelings and the Great Link. I mean, from the very moment that Odo went into the Gamma Quadrant, he was drawn to his people. It was a genetic drive. I think about when he was being interrogated by Garak, you know, saying to Garak, listen, I just want to go home. You know, there's this genetic drive. It was, you know, when everything else, all of the layers of Odo had been peeled away in that interrogation, the one thing that remained was his desire, his drive to join his people, even though philosophically, even though ideologically, he was not compatible with them, he still had this genetic drive to join them in the Great Link.
I'm glad you thought to mention Odo, because Odo's instinctive behavior in that regard, you know, his biological drive to rejoin the Great Link, is on this reading of determinism, this biological determinism, kind of a placeholder for all human actions, right? Any human action that looks like it's freely chosen on this really strong biological reading is more like an instinctive behavior. So even something as simple as what kind of tea I'm having tonight, or, you know, what I'm going to go do for lunch, or what career I'm going to choose, you know, whatever choice it happens to be, you can kind of interpret that as a biological instinct and not a free choice. And I think you hit the nail on the head that for Odo, the instincts are so powerful, they sort of override every other factor, every other value, every other choice that he has. He still has this instinctive behavior programmed into him that is an overriding factor for him. And I think that's the point of this view of determinism, this biological determinism, that all actions that look like they're freely chosen are really just instinctive behaviors of in one variety or another.
Yeah. And Zachary, I'd be remiss if I failed to mention a couple of great examples that our wonderful producer Dennis brought to us after we put together a pilot episode. You already mentioned the augments from Enterprise season 4 arc. You know, they almost seemed destined to become, much like the Jem'Hadar, super soldiers, almost evil because of their genetic makeup. And I think that's probably a good discussion for our next episode, because what choices were actually theirs and what was actually determined by their genetic makeup. The other example of biological determinism that he mentioned is the Vulcan Ponfar. And again, we'll probably discuss this a little bit more next time when we discuss free will and compatibilism, but to what degree in a mock time was Spock actually responsible for his actions when he supposedly killed Kirk in that combat ritual? You know, was he responsible for those actions? He evidently felt that he was, because he surrendered himself, you know, to be arrested, and you know, then he sees that Kirk's alive, and we see a little bit of his human biology pop out. One of the few times we see Spock smile.
You know, it's interesting as you're describing those examples. I was thinking of there's kind of a danger in starting to talk about Star Trek and philosophy of conflating issues that are really separate issues. They're related issues, but really separate issues. You know, there's the one issue at hand, the one we're talking about right now, is the issue of whether or not certain actions are freely chosen or determined, right? This free will determinism debate in some sort of metaphysical sense. Do we really have free will in some metaphysical sense, or are all of our actions determined in some sort of physical causation sense, right? That's kind of a factual question about how reality works, right? When I make a choice, what is going on there? What's the mechanism? Is it free or is it determined? And then there's this separate issue, you could call it another meta issue, but in this case, it's more like an ethical issue. But right, you know, given that, however that discussion shakes out, to what extent do we hold people responsible, right? Do we hold Spock responsible for his actions in, you know, when he's in Ponfar? Do we hold the augments responsible, given that they're programmed to be super soldiers? And that's really kind of a separate question. You know, it's related. You can link the two. Your answer to the first question might influence your answer to the second question, but there's a danger of kind of reading in the ethical judgments into the metaphysical question about what's actually true and how actions that look like they're free actions really occur.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Zachary, let's move on to physical, or what we call nomological, determinism.
You know, this is probably my favorite part of the determinism debate, because I think it's the most fundamental challenge to free will. And the idea here is that all human actions might be determined not by necessarily by biological factors, but at the most fundamental level of physics, laws of nature, laws of physics. And so this is called physical determinism or nomological determinism. And I know that's a heavy word, nomological, but it's actually comes from the Greek word nomos, that means law. So a law of nature or a law of physics. And so the idea here is that maybe reality is set up in such a way that it's that all events are basically a result of a series of causes and effects, right? Whatever happens had a bunch of prior causes, and those were effects of even prior causes. And so you can kind of break all of reality and all events down into a very complicated chain of causes and effects that are deterministic. You know, such that if you knew all of the causal factors, you know, maybe you knew all the positions of every particle in the universe and you knew their trajectories and where they were headed, and you could take every factor into account, you could kind of run the clock backward or forward and be able to, you know, predict future states of affairs or analyze, sort of run the clock backwards and look at the causal effects that that necessitated reality being the way it is. But the idea here is that, you know, if reality just works that way, if it's deterministic, if all events are just a result of causes and effects that are deterministic, then there just doesn't seem like there's any room for free will. All actions seem like they're fully determined by prior causes. And so in what sense can there be an action that's freely chosen?
Yeah, and this is one where I admittedly I'm going to have to restrain myself a little bit, and I know you will as well, because we're getting into a subject that I could really geek out about. In fact, I recently did Ready Room 188, where we talked about E squared, the Enterprise encounter with another NX-01, which was being run by the descendants of Archer and his crew, season 3, I think it was episode 21. This is, I think, probably a prime example of what we're talking about here. You know, so when I joined Christopher and Warp 5's Norm Lau and Will Nguyen, we had this great discussion that almost could have gotten out of hand, because the interesting dilemma here is that are their choices predictable by virtue of this time travel paradox? You know, in fact, in the episode, Lorian is willing to kill his ancestors to complete the mission and make the rendezvous with Degra. You know, he even says in the episode that, you know, Archer's about to make the same mistake, and this is going to cause this paradox. So you've got this great debate here. If, you know, if we go back in time, and they talk about this all the time in the Star Trek universe, are we going to influence the timeline? Will the choices be the same? What if they're different? You know, if Marty's parents don't meet at the dance, you know, Marty's arm's going to disappear. And I've completely digressed into Back to the Future, but yeah, it is. And almost October. What is it, 21st?
Well, it is 2015.
Yeah, to pay homage to Back to the Future. But, I mean, prime example right there, E squared.
Yeah, we're 10 days away. So, you know, we could certainly take a little time to talk about Back to the Future. But I'm glad you mentioned Back to the Future, because there's, you know, when we think about Star Trek and free will and determinism, I really want to start asking these questions. Like, how does the Star Trek universe think about the nature of reality? You know, can you give a systematic, coherent account of how the Star Trek universe thinks about the nature of reality? And, you know, one thing that's a common theme in Star Trek, you know, comes up quite often, you know, in various episodes and movies, is this idea of time travel and time travel paradoxes, right? So that you see examples of people going back in time and making some sort of changes that result in either an alternate timeline or changes to the timeline in some way. But the idea is that, as I think about this, I have a hard time imagining what a world would be like, a world in which time travel is possible, like you see in the Star Trek universe, without some sort of determinism, right? If you go back in time and you change something, and then the timeline unfolds in a different way, doesn't that just seem to imply the idea that the future is determined by the past, right? It's hard to imagine how you could have a time travel story or a time travel paradox when that wasn't taken into account. So in my mind, these time travel paradoxes you see in Star Trek really kind of imply that Star Trek has an overall deterministic view of the nature of reality, right? If you go back in time, change something, the future is going to unfold in a different way. But that's because the future is predicted based on past events and causes. So, again, if you can sort of run the clock forward in that way, what room is there for free will, given that the future seems to be determined by past events, in broad brushstrokes in the Star Trek universe?
Yeah. I'm surprised more people don't practice time travel. After all, it's a fairly simple thing. You just do the slingshot maneuver around the sun, right?
Exactly.
It's very simple. I'm surprised more people don't try to do it. But I think for me, it harkens back a little bit to First Contact in the way that it leaves one wondering if the paradox itself is determined. You know, with First Contact, you know, was Riker and LaForge destined to be on board the Phoenix with Zefram Cochrane for its fated first flight? You know, was that a determined paradox in and of itself? E squared, we go back to E squared. Was that a determined event that they were supposed to go back in time, and therefore Enterprise becomes a generational ship that their descendants would eventually learn to operate and meet them there in order to help them finish the mission and make the rendezvous with Degra?
It's interesting because there are sort of two terms that are, again, they're sort of in danger of being conflated. This is like the philosopher's toolbox, right? When in doubt, make a distinction.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, there's the one sense of determinism in the sense of whatever events occur are determined by prior causes, whatever those causes may have been. But then there's determined in the sense of predestined or some sort of deeper destiny that has some sort of meaning to it, right? If Riker was always supposed to have been on the Phoenix, right, that sounds more like predestiny than this yes. weaker sense of determinism, this idea that whatever events are, they're just determined by whatever, you know, came immediately before it and whatever came immediately before that. There's no deep sense of meaning there, like reality just had to be that way and it's important and meaningful that it is that way. And I think it's easy to conflate this idea of predestination and this idea that Riker was always supposed to have been on the Phoenix, or that these paradoxes are supposed to have been wound up in paradoxes, and that reality was always supposed to have been that way from the beginning, sounds a little more like predestination to me.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that Dr. Bashir was never predestined to hook up with Lieutenant Whatley in Trials and Tribulations.
Well, you never know.
He didn't disappear when they went back, so I think that's probably safe to say.
You know, the example that comes to my mind, again, I love looking for examples, because this is part of the fun of talking about this issue with Star Trek examples, is that you can find different types of examples that kind of pull your intuitions one way or another. The example that comes to my mind here is the example of parallels in Star Trek The Next Generation. right? Remember in that example, the boundaries between different parallel universes are starting to break down, and enterprises from different parallel universes are all converging in the same spot in space-time. And each of these enterprises has a different causal history, right? In one case, Captain Picard was killed in an encounter with the Borg. In another case, they've been at war the entire time, and so on and so forth. Doesn't matter what the particular examples are. But here's a case where you have different instances of the Enterprise that have very different histories, and you can kind of ask the question, well, how did they come to have these different histories? Are they different because the characters in those universes made different choices, right? Did Picard choose to fight the Borg a certain way or fight the Borg a different way? And is that what resulted in this divergence in the timeline? Because should you spell it out in terms of different freely chosen actions? Or are those universes different because their causal histories are different? if you rewind the course of events in each of those alternate universes backwards, were the initial states of affairs different in each of those universes? Were the initial conditions of the Big Bang Theory different for one universe versus another, such that predictably, because of deterministic causes and effects, did each of those universes unfold in a different way because of deterministic factors or freely chosen factors? So I love the example of parallels because I think it really kind of forces the issue. You've got examples of, they're the same ship, the Enterprise, but they have very different histories. How did they come to be that way? And do you interpret that because of free will, or do you interpret that because of determinism?
Yeah, I think that's a great example. In fact, I think it's implied in that episode, Zachary, that it was the differences between the timelines, and there were literally thousands of converging timelines, so much so that Data had calculated that, if something doesn't happen, then, we're going to fill our known space. And then we get into all of the, temporal mechanics. Can they occupy the same space? And like I said, we can geek out all day about that, but I kind of was sticking that in my back pocket for the conversation about free will and compatibilism, because I think it's implied there in that episode that it was a matter of different choices, and each of those choices created a different timeline. So now we have thousands of them converging in on one another.
Yeah, and it's hard to have this discussion because every time someone wants to mention free will, the philosopher in me wants to come along and say, well, it looks like it's freely chosen action, but is it really freely chosen action given the laws of physics and given the character's biological makeup and whatnot? Can you give a deterministic reading of anything that looks like freely chosen action? So, I think when I think about determinism, I think of this physical or nomological determinism as the biggest, most serious challenge to free will. The idea that if all of reality is just set up in a deterministic way in a chain of causes and effects, what room is there left for free will? And the Star Trek universe is a very scientistic universe in the sense of the characters in Star Trek and sort of the mission of Star Trek to go out and seek and explore new worlds and make new contacts and whatnot is largely scientifically driven, right? Whenever a mysterious phenomenon is encountered, without fail, the Federation and Starfleet tend to prefer a scientific explanation of that phenomenon. And so for within the Star Trek universe, it strikes me that the scientific explanation in terms of natural causes and effects is kind of the preferred type of explanation. But that hasn't always been obvious in the history of philosophy. And this is what's fun, I think, to bring a little bit of philosophy to talking about these issues in Star Trek. For example, the philosopher Immanuel Kant claimed that even causes and effects, things that look like natural causes and effects and laws of nature, things that look deterministic, aren't really features of reality in themselves. They're features of the way we perceive reality, that reality is kind of inherently unknown, but our minds impose this structure on reality, whatever that reality is. We analyze it in terms of number and causes and effects and any number of other categories that are sort of inherent and ingrained in our mind. But that doesn't mean that they're part of reality. So even a philosopher like Kant, who does prefer naturalistic explanations of phenomena, he's part of the Enlightenment movement, right? He wanted to try to preserve the room for scientific explanations. You know, he's in the middle of the 18th century, right? Smack in the middle of the Enlightenment. But even a philosopher like Kant didn't think that that had anything to do with reality in itself. So there's a distinction between how reality is perceived and how reality really is. And so even if things look like they're determined or look like they're to be explained in terms of causes and effects, maybe that's just a matter of how our minds are perceiving whatever reality is rather than reality in itself. So it's not obvious that a scientific explanation is always the preferred explanation. It tends to be that way in Star Trek, but in the history of philosophy, that's just one type of explanation. And there's countless other types of explanations, metaphysical explanations or ethical explanations or theological explanations. And it's, it's almost too easy to take the scientific explanation as the preferred explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's move on to social or cultural determinism.
You know, this is an interesting type of determinism. You know, we've got biological determinism, we've got physical determinism, but social and cultural determinism is the question of whether human actions are determined by social and cultural and political factors, again, which are outside your control, right? And as I was thinking of examples before the show today of social and cultural determinism, the example that came immediately to my mind is the example of Picard and Shinzon in Star Trek Nemesis. There's a case where the two characters have the exact same genes, right? They're, you know, Shinzon is a clone of Picard, so the same genetic makeup, the same genetic potential. In fact, they even refer to it that way inside the movie, right? Shinzon said he's got the same potential as Picard. But because of their radically different upbringings and backgrounds, right? Picard grew up in the Federation and has Federation values and whatnot. And Shinzon, of course, was a prison laborer on the Riemann world. And that really shapes their backgrounds so much so that even though they have the same biological potential, their actions are determined and their lives are steered in different directions because of these other factors, these social and cultural factors. And to me, it's interesting because that's kind of what makes Shinzon a tragic character, right? He does have the potential of being a Picard, but he's so determined by these factors that shaped his upbringing that he just can't overcome them. Even if he sort of hints at wanting to overcome them, Picard challenges Shinzon and says, you can make the right choice right now, right? You've got a choice, make the right one. And he says, I can't change who I am. And that's kind of tragic. But the interesting question is whether all action is like that, right? Are human actions or any character you encounter inside the Star Trek universe, are their actions so determined by social and cultural factors that anything that looks like a free choice can really be explained by their prior backgrounds, their social and cultural conditioning?
Yeah, in fact, Shinzon counter-challenges Picard, I believe, by saying, if you would have been in my world, you'd be doing the same things here. And this is, philosophically, this is where I think most behaviorists like B.F. Skinner would really be anchored. You know, the idea here is that these causal factors lay in the environment. Three characters, I think, probably come to mind most for me: Worf, Odo, and Spock. And the thing that these three characters all have in common is that they are men of two worlds. You know, Worf was, biologically, he was a Klingon, but he was raised among humans. Odo was a founder who was raised among solids. Spock, interestingly enough, had a Vulcan father. He had a human mother. And even though his choice was to observe Kolinar and to follow the Vulcan path, still he wrestled with the two halves of himself, trying to find that balance between his Vulcan half and his human half. These are all three men of two worlds.
And until I started thinking about this issue, I didn't quite realize the extent to which the character development in Star Trek, right? These characters that are children of two worlds, Spock and Worf and the others, they, the tension between their two worlds, right? Their conditioning based on their ties to two worlds or the tension between their biological conditioning and their cultural conditioning. It really results in the dramatic progression for those characters, right? That's the character development that's inherent to those characters. But all of it kind of rests on the idea that you know, say a character like Worf, you know, he is biologically Klingon and he even has some Klingon values, maybe an idealized form of Klingon values, but he also has Federation ideals because of some other types of conditioning and upbringing. And there's an inherent tension between those. And that's what makes Worf such an interesting character. And it's interesting that the, even the character development itself in Star Trek is sort of grounded in this idea of determinism, that this social and cultural determinism. You know, while I really sort of fundamentally am most interested in the philosophical issues kind of themselves, right? You know, are Worf's actions really free or not? Are Spock's actions really free or not? Or are my actions really free or not, for that matter? You know, I love these characters. And what I love about these characters is kind of their inherent tension. And it's just an interesting, you know, side fact to note the fact that these characters, what makes them so interesting is the fact that their personalities are rooted in these things that are deeply seated and outside of their control.
Yeah, I think there's a great example in Voyager. I believe the episode is called Nemesis, where Chakotay is captured by the Vori when his shuttle goes down. They really begin to condition him to hate their nemesis, the Kraydon. And this cultural conditioning and manipulation, it's so effective that by the end of the episode, after Chakotay's completely learned the truth, he still has this inner conflict, right? He even says to Janeway in that final scene, and Robert Beltran plays it so well. He's standing there. The Kraydon ambassador says, "I'm glad we were able to get you out of there. I hope everything's going to be okay." And you just don't know, you know, what Chakotay is going to do at that moment. Is he going to attack this guy? What's he going to do? He turns around. He walks off after sort of staring him down. Janeway follows him out into the corridor and says, you know, to him, "Hey, what's going on?" And he says to her, he says, "I cared about the Vori, but I hated the Kraydon. I wanted to kill every one of them." And he says to her, he says, "I wish it was as easy to stop hating as it was to start." And I think that's a great example here where we kind of see it in universe in a single episode rather than probably more naturally drawn out over the course of a character's development in a series. But here we see Chakotay in a single episode being conditioned to hate and seeing how that cultural conditioning affects his actions and his behavior.
And what I love about that example is it really forces the issue of how strong of a factor the social and cultural conditioning can be, right? In the case of Chakotay in that episode, that's a really extreme case, almost an isolated case, right? He's gone through this extreme conditioning. It's caused some extreme reactions that are outside of his control. But that's not the day-to-day life for Chakotay, right? This was an extreme example that has some long-lasting consequences, at least until the next episode, right? But you know, you can ask the question, okay, that's an extreme example. What about the ordinary examples, right? When Chakotay decides to be a vegetarian 1 week or a vegetarian, not a vegetarian the next week. You know, are these things that are these ordinary day-to-day decisions, are they a result of social and cultural conditioning, or is that conditioning really only salient and a significant factor in those really extreme cases like being conditioned to go fight a war?
I think this played a big part in the development of Seven of Nine as well, kind of sticking with the Voyager theme. You know, we see her liberated from the Borg, but over the course of her character's development, you know, she, on purpose, you know, she is surrounding herself with these cultural influences in hopes of refining her character a little bit. And I think that's a great example there where we see it a little bit broader in the development of a character as a whole. In fact, she seeks out the Doctor to kind of help her in that cultural development so that, you know, her interpersonal skills are a little more refined and so on.
Yeah, and you can find countless other examples. I think, you know, we don't need to list hundreds more examples, but you can take any decision of any character inside the Star Trek universe and kind of run the clock backwards. Like, you know, what was their conditioning and their background, and what kinds of implicit conditioning is a factor in making those decisions. You know, and all of our lives are like that, right? You know, I've chose to record a podcast with you tonight, but is that a freely chosen action, or is that a result of my educational conditioning and my upbringing and my interests that are you know, all these things I can mention that are social and cultural and not really things that were freely chosen by me in my earlier life. They led up to, you know, tonight recording a podcast. Janeway decides to have a certain reaction in a certain situation. Is that a freely chosen action, or is that a result of her Starfleet conditioning and her upbringing and whatnot? You can always kind of tell that cultural conditioning story for any action you like. And the question that's interesting to me is whether that is an overriding factor. Is that something that prohibits the possibility of those actions also being freely chosen, or are they in some way compatible with the idea that those actions are free?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's move along to, we want to talk just very briefly about evolutionary determinism. Are certain traits inevitable as a product of our natural evolution?
Yeah, I really wanted to work this one in here, evolutionary determinism, because I think there's kind of this implicit assumption in the popular discussion of the evolutionary process that evolution is kind of radically open-ended, a result of radically contingent events and factors and whatnot, such that any variety of creatures can emerge in the course of the evolutionary history of a world, right? On Earth, you can see a radical diversity of different types of beings as a result of really contingent events. So inside the Star Trek universe, you tend to get examples of evolutionary processes that are more deterministic, right? On any given world, where there are sentient intelligent beings, a lot of them are humanoid, right? You get they're bipedal and humanoid, and they're intelligent, and they have opposable thumbs, and they look an awful lot like us, and think an awful lot like us. And of course, that's, if you ask a Star Trek producer, why do you have all these humanoid characters? Well, because we only have humanoid actors. But there is something to be said for that in the Star Trek universe, there is this kind of predictable evolutionary process that if you leave a world alone, it will eventually, hopefully, develop beings that are intelligent and that we can communicate with and form treaties with, and maybe they'll join the Federation. But there's kind of a direction to the evolutionary process, and you can even see that on our own world. We tend to see a progression of evolution towards beings that are more complicated, that have higher levels of intelligence. And the interesting question there is, the evolutionary process really radically open-ended, or is it geared towards producing beings that have certain types of properties? And if the latter is the case, then there's kind of a directional predictability and necessity to the evolutionary process. And that goes counter to, I think, how a lot of people think of evolution. But the Star Trek universe seems to kind of take for granted that the evolutionary process leads towards sentient beings. And even on our own world, you can sort of see an increase in complexity in different types of forms with certain types of qualities. But does that make evolution kind of a deterministic factor that leads to certain types of outcomes if you let the evolutionary process run long enough?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I think Star Trek does a very good job of exploring both ideas of macroevolution and microevolution in terms of, very broad evolution, such as the evolution of an entire species, but also the microevolutions that happen within that species. Probably the most broad example I can think of would be Next Generation, Genesis, where everybody kind of starts to de-evolve, and interestingly enough, into creatures that are very similar to the personalities of the characters themselves. Let's talk about historical determinism.
Yeah, I'm glad we put this on the list. Historical determinism is this idea that certain historical events are somewhat inevitable based on prior historical events. So it's a little different from physical or nomological determinism, right? There you're talking sort of like talking about microcausation, right? Little chains of causes and effects that are really complex. But here we're talking about big, important historical events and the connection between those. So, as this applies to the Star Trek universe, you can ask, are certain historical events in Star Trek inevitable based on prior historical events? And I'm thinking of things like the rise of the Federation, or the cultural progression or enlightenment of different alien races. I recently watched Unification in Star Trek The Next Generation, and Spock makes the claim that the Romulans are on a progression, an inevitable progression towards the ideals of Vulcan philosophy. Is that kind of progression an inevitable trajectory based on where the Romulans' historical chain of events? And as I think about something like the rise of the Federation, you can ask, you know, given first contact with the Vulcans, I recently also watched Star Trek First Contact. I'm thinking of, you know, first contact with the Vulcans, given an event like that, and the ensuing progression of Starfleet out into the galaxy and the connections that are formed and the relationships, all the things you see in Star Trek Enterprise, is the Federation kind of an inevitable outcome of all of that, all of those prior events? You know, on the one hand, they look like they're really contingent, right? Maybe the Vulcans and humans wouldn't have made first contact in that way, and such that the Federation wouldn't have happened. Or are those important events so important, and is the force of them so strong that they override any of the individual choices that people make along the way, right? You can kind of think in terms of, I think of examples in our own world, like think of some major historical event like Pearl Harbor or September 11th. Those factors set human history, at least recent human history, on a trajectory that is not under the influence of any one individual choice that's made, right? Any choices I make don't affect the trajectory of world history, given those major historical events. And in the Star Trek universe, can you point to these events like treaties being formed, or the Federation being formed, or the cultural progression of a certain alien race? Are those kinds of things inevitable and beyond the scope of influence of individual choice?
Yeah, and Zachary, you mentioned the rise of the Federation. You know, Enterprise Season 1, the cliffhanger shockwave, I think really delves into this idea. There's this dialogue between Daniels and Archer. They're stuck in the 31st century, and everything's changed because Archer wasn't there. He was this pivotal character in terms of the founding of the Federation. And because he wasn't there, he was kind of like this linchpin. Once he was plucked out of history, then everything kind of unraveled from there. And Daniels really drives home this point that, you know, we've got to get you back. You need to be there. You need to be present in order for these events to unfold the way they're supposed to. So, you know, when we talk about historical determinism, then we get down to the characters that actually are a part of that history, and we can look at it in terms of American history. You know, would the United States of America be what it is today if George Washington hadn't have been there? Or would our country have had a civil war had it not been for Abraham Lincoln? Or if it would have ended up in civil war, is the fact that Abraham Lincoln was there, did that have a direct effect? So we can kind of see this play out, you know, in our own history, but, you know, here in universe, so to speak, in Star Trek, we see it playing out here in this Enterprise Season 1 cliffhanger, you know, as Jonathan Archer is this linchpin character in which everything unravels because he's not there for it.
Yeah, you know, as I think this through, you know, you and I have been talking about this topic for a while now. In fact, our listeners don't know this, but we did a couple of trial episodes where we went through these topics and had a sort of preliminary version of this discussion. But as I think through this more and more, I find this very interesting, because there's just so much to say, right? Can you take this progression of historical events? Like I said, are they outside the scope of an individual's control, or can you kind of analyze those historical events in terms of very significant individual human agents and actors, right? Take the founding of the Federation. Is that such an overriding trajectory that the Star Trek universe is on? Or can you kind of say, well, you can break that down in terms of the individual choices of Jonathan Archer and company along the way. So what's the right way to interpret those kinds of events? Are they these very broad brushstroke deterministic trajectories, or are they really explainable in terms of individual human actions like Jonathan Archer and the other characters inside Star Trek Enterprise? And I should say, too, that there's a lot of controversy here. I think it's, you know, when we talk about historical determinism, that itself is a concept that makes actual historians very nervous. Most modern historians don't think of history as being progressive or goal-oriented. There's a word for that, teleological, directed towards a telos or an end. You know, if history is progressive, then... I was going to say, most historians sort of think of world history as being a conjunction or an amalgamation of radically contingent events, right? A collection of different perspectives and different events that didn't have to be different interpretations of historical events. They don't see any sort of broad progressiveness to history. But in the history of philosophy, you can find philosophers that have this progressive view of history. I'm thinking of philosophers like Hegel, the German philosopher who thought that world history was progressive, that if you looked at the history of the world from and its political structures, going from things like dictatorships and, you know, rule by a king or an absolute ruler to something like aristocracy that you see in Europe and in the Middle Ages and whatnot, all the way into the modern period where you find rule by democracy. At every turn, there's kind of a progressiveness, an increase in freedom. And he used a term Geist for it, which is translated as spirit, but really it means something like freedom, but in some sort of metaphysical sense. But Hegel thought that world history is progressive towards an increase in freedom. But most modern historians really kind of reject that idea. They just think of history as this very complicated, loosely arranged collection of interpretations and contingent events. They don't see any progressiveness to it. And that when history is interpreted in some sort of progressive way, it's often misused in some sort of political sense with an agenda. Gender, right? Like in the Federation, if the Federation tells a story about itself in terms of being some sort of an ideal or a necessary outcome of these prior events, there's the risk of saying that Federation ideals are placed above ideals of other cultures, and at the same time, the Federation wants to have this kind of pluralistic, relativistic view of other cultures, right? The Federation's values aren't necessarily better than Klingon values or Romulan values or any other race they might encounter. But they do kind of have a vested interest in developing positive relationships with other cultures and entering into treaties with them and maybe convincing them to join the Federation. And so there's kind of this tension when we talk about historical determinism in the Star Trek universe of kind of viewing Federation ideals and the Federation political structures as the ideals towards which different cultures should be progressing if we leave them to their own devices because of the Prime Directive. Or the historical progressions of different races and different worlds kind of radically contingent, right? Is it okay that the Klingons don't want to join the Federation or the Romulans don't want to join the Federation? Or does that mean they're sort of historically and culturally defective in some way? And so I think there's a lot to say here. You know, philosophically, you can kind of ask the question, does history really work this way? Is it directed towards some goal that is an ideal? Or is it really kind of radically contingent and maybe even analyzable in terms of individual choices?
Yeah, it's a fun debate, but we are moving in on an hour here, and we've got a couple other examples of determinism we want to touch on before we wrap up the show today.
Yeah, let's run through these really quickly. So the next thing on our list here is psychological determinism. And this way, I think we can just talk about really quickly. It's the idea that behavior is determined by psychological facts that are outside your control. And I'm thinking here of things like your subconscious or things like, you know, if you're conditioned to act a certain way and that's conditioned your psychology, things that are true of you psychologically, right? Like maybe your Myers-Briggs personality test or things that are true in your subconscious that you're not necessarily aware of, but are still driving your behavior. And I think you can find some examples of this in the Star Trek universe, but really you can probably break these down in terms of cultural conditioning or biological determinism. I'm not really convinced that it's a substantively distinct types of determinism in its own right, but we do have this vocabulary, right? We can say, is a certain character in Star Trek, are they being influenced by their subconscious rather than their conscious awareness of themselves? Can you think of any examples off the top of your head, Mike, of psychological determinism in Star Trek?
Not to a great extent. This is another area where behaviorists like Skinner root the core idea of causal factors that are reinforcers or punishments. You know, we kind of get into the realm of reductionism. You know, that would be one school of such thought that says that human behavior can be best explained by breaking it down to smaller components, and that these causal components can really predict behavior. The best example I can think of is Suter from Voyager. He saw himself as a killer. There was no free will. There was no motivation, just this uncontrollable impulse to kill. And, you know, it took a mind meld with Tuvok in order for him to gain the mental discipline that he needed in order to control his behavior to, you know, to a great degree.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm not really convinced that this is a different type of determinism, right? And the example you mentioned can be spelled out in terms of cultural conditioning or your upbringing or maybe some biological defect in the character's brain, right? Mm-hmm. There's other ways of spelling it out besides the psychological. But that's an interesting question in its own right. One, I actually hope we can talk about this issue in an upcoming episode, this idea of reductionism versus emergence, right? Mm-hmm. This comes up in any area of thought, philosophy, any of the sciences, any of the social sciences, all have this issue. Yeah. And the issue is whether these higher levels of description, like psychology, right? That's a high level of description versus something like physics. That's a really low level of description, a sort of fundamental description of reality, right? And at every turn, at each level of science, right, you can ask, is that level reducible to the next lowest level, right? Mm-hmm. Is psychology just reducible to neurochemistry? Is neurochemistry just reducible to chemistry? Is chemistry just reducible to physics?
Yeah.
And should everything be explained in terms of physics, or does a psychological description or a sociological description, or you know, a galactic sociological description on the scale of the Star Trek universe, right? Are these substantively distinct types of descriptions that add something above and beyond these lower levels of description, or can you just take any description you want at a high level and reduce it right down to these lower level factors? And that's a separate discussion in its own right. But that's really what's coming up here. When I hear psychological determinism, I immediately want to ask, yeah, but isn't psychology just neurochemistry, right?
Yes.
Aren't we really just talking about biological determinism, or aren't we just talking about cultural determinism and whatnot? It's that comes up at every turn. Whenever you invoke these higher level descriptions, you immediately have to ask, yeah, but is there really something substantively different there, or is it just reducible to these lower levels?
Yeah, and can we reduce it down and thus predict behavior? It's controversial, but. Definitely something for a future podcast.
But you know, it's interesting because you can find examples of that contemporarily, and you can find examples of this in the Star Trek universe, right? You know, there's a reason that we've had success treating psychological disorders with medicines, right? With pills. We can just say, okay, you've got a certain kind of psychological defect. Have a pill. It'll make you all better, right? You're sort of taking the psychology and reducing it to chemistry and mm-hmm. neurochemistry. And same thing, I'm thinking here of the example you mentioned before of the Jem'Hadar, right? You can take their behavior and you can explain it in terms of the chemistry of tetracell white. And that's an example of reductionism in the Star Trek universe, right? You take this higher level of the politics and the psychology and the behavioral aspects of the Jem'Hadar, and you can immediately reduce it right down to a lower level of description, the chemical interaction of this drug that they're being injected with and their neurochemistry, and explain everything in terms of that. So in what sense do we need sociology or psychology? Can't we just reduce everything to whatever's going on at this lower level?
Yeah, that's great. I didn't even think of that. You definitely hit the nail on the head there, drawing the line to the Jem'Hadar. Well, Zachary, the final type of determinism we want to talk about is theological determinism. And this one, especially for me being a person of faith, is one that I like to think about.
Yeah, I think if you're a person of faith, if you're a theist, you're going to find theological determinism really interesting. You know, if you have a prophetic worldview or an apocalyptic worldview, if you have the view that history and the progression of events in the universe or in the world is being influenced by any sort of divine factor, then you're going to find this really interesting. If that's not part of your worldview, it might be hard to take theological determinism seriously. But regardless, you can find examples of this inside the Star Trek universe, right? And the thing that comes immediately to my mind is Bajoran prophecy, right? All of Deep Space Nine was set up with this sort of tension between the Federation's scientific worldview and the Bajorans' theological worldview in mind, right? That's an inherent part of the tension of the show. And there are events in Deep Space Nine having to do with Sisko's role as the emissary and the events that ensue in the course of Deep Space Nine leading up to the final episode that are predicted by Bajoran prophecy. such that, you know, in again, it's kind of like the historical determinism problem all over again, right? These theological factors, these prophecies are so overriding that the consequences that are predicted are inevitable, right? No matter what anyone does, there are certain things that are going to unfold because of these prophecies.
Yeah, and this is something that they explore quite a bit, you know, throughout DS9. You mentioned Trekor's prophecies in the episode Destiny, Accession, from the fourth season, where the poet Akoram Lan, you know, returns to Bajor. He comes out of the wormhole 200 years removed from his disappearance, and he comes back believing that he actually is the emissary to the prophets. Of course, Sisko, who's very uncomfortable with his role as emissary, gladly steps aside. And, you know, so Akoram Lan says, hey, everybody, we need to return to the Dajaras. That's the reason why the prophets have sent me back, to tell you that we need to return to the Dajaras. And, of course, we find out that has nothing to do with why he was sent back. We have a tendency sometimes, I think, to interpret, you know, whether it be prophecy, whether it be history, whether it be literature, we have a tendency sometimes to interpret things through our own lens. We see that, you know, going back to Destiny, you know, the way that throughout that episode, their interpretation of Trekor's prophecy changed. And we have the tendency to bend the prophecy to fit the circumstances. And sometimes we have a tendency to kind of self-fulfill prophecy and bend the circumstances so that it meets the terms of the prophecy.
Yeah, and I think that's the danger there. You can always reinterpret a prophecy. You can, for any event that unfolds, you can kind of tell a new story about that event in terms of whatever prophecies you happen to hold are true. And but you know, again, this is, none of that answers the philosophical question, right? The philosophical question is, you know, on this theological worldview, if those prophecies are genuine, right? If they're not just constructions of a particular culture that aren't actually true, but in universe now, right? If the Bajoran prophecies are actually true, and the prophets or the wormhole aliens have preordained certain things to unfold, doesn't it sure look like certain events are necessary? And then, of course, there's how there's the characters' reactions to those prophecies, right? An individual character could be mistaken or could be accurate about what those prophecies mean and what we should do about those prophecies. But, you know, if you have a theological worldview, in other words, if there's some sort of divine being that has an influence on the progression of history, then it sure looks like some things are inevitable regardless of what any individual chooses to do or not do.
Yeah. And we also, going to, I believe it's the episode's called Till Death Do Us Part, we see where wormhole aliens or the prophets, whatever our listeners want to call them, and we'll leave that open for debate. But, you know, the prophets told Sisko, you know, first of all, they told him that he wouldn't find rest on Bajor. And then they said to him, you know, listen, if you marry Cassidy Yates, that's going to be bad news. And so what does he do? You know, he has to make a decision. Am I going to let theological determinism, and that's really what it boiled down to, am I going to let theological determinism control my actions, or am I going to invoke my personal agency? And of course, he marries Cassidy Yates, and we see how that played out. That's a great one, I think, that almost segues into our discussion next time about free will and compatibilism.
Yeah, I was thinking that exactly, that as we talk about theological determinism, it really forces the issue, right? Given this worldview that certain events are preordained, how do you respond to that? Do you let that be, you know, do you let that create some sort of fatalism in you? Or should that spawn some sort of free agency? Like, how do I respond to this using my own free will, given these things I believe? And I think you can take any one of these types of determinism and you can say, okay, yeah, so what? What do we do as humans in response to that now? What should our attitude and our response be? Can we even control it? And there's all of these ways of thinking about how to approach free will, given the background of these different types of deterministic factors. But again, we're going to break this episode into two parts, right? We're going to talk about determinism tonight, and we spelled out different kinds of determinism, and we're going to pick this back up next week and talk about different kinds of free will and things like the pragmatic view of free will and the existentialist view of free will, and see if we can find examples of those kinds of free will in the Star Trek universe as well. So given that, Mike, you know, we've been going for about an hour now. Why don't we wrap it up with some final thoughts? What do you make as a whole, now that we've talked about a few examples of determinism in Star Trek, what do you make as a whole of how the Star Trek universe handles an issue like free will and determinism, even though we've only had the first half of the discussion?
Yeah, Zachary, we've cited quite a few examples, and we've name dropped several philosophers today on the podcast when we're talking here about determinism. You know, we've said this before as we've been discussing the subject. You know, Star Trek does a great job of raising the questions, and I think by design it doesn't necessarily answer those questions. You know, certainly within the context of Star Trek, we can see how internal and external causal factors can certainly influence the behavior of human beings or androids or aliens. But, you know, I personally believe that there's a strong case in the universe for personal agency or free will, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, because we can't predict a person's behavior 100%. So when we're talking about the complexities of various causal factors and we bring those things into consideration, I think there's definitely fuel there for the argument of free will, or at the least compatibilism. In the original series episode, Return of the Archons, you know, Kirk realizes that he has to outwit Landru in order to release the people of Beta 3 from the control of this machine. And Kirk says, without freedom of choice, there is no creativity. Without creativity, there is no life. So I think the debate goes on.
You know, I think I agree that generally the Star Trek universe does a better job of raising philosophical issues and questions and distinctions than really answering those issues. That said, one thing I've always loved about studying philosophy and the history of philosophy is the diversity of different kinds of positions that are out there. Take an issue like free will and determinism. It's very easy to kind of oversimplify the issue and just say, you know, at every turn, do we have free will or do we not have free will? Do we have free will or do we not have free will? But what's interesting philosophically is breaking that issue down into different categories with different kinds of distinctions, different types of theories. You know, tonight we talked about, you know, six or seven different kinds of determinism. Next week, we're going to talk about a few different kinds of free will. And on each one of these different positions, what was fascinating to me as I started thinking about looking at these issues through the lens of Star Trek is that you can really take each one of these different kinds of positions that are part of the philosophical literature and part of the academic discussion of philosophy, and you can actually find really good substantive examples of those distinctions and concepts and theories right inside the Star Trek universe, right? We can have a perfectly intelligent discussion, a very rich philosophical discussion on free will and determinism using solely examples from the Star Trek universe itself. Like you said, we name dropped a couple of philosophers like Immanuel Kant, but we didn't even have to do that, right? We could have just talked solely about Star Trek examples and had a perfectly intelligent, rich, philosophically interesting discussion using only those examples. So I'm really excited. You know, this feels like a really new project for me. I know this is our first a real episode one of MetaTreks. I'm anxious to see, you know, what new issues we're going to talk about and what examples we find, things I haven't thought about before when I've watched Star Trek, even though I've been having a career as a professional philosopher for quite a few years now. This feels like a really new project. I don't think that a project like this has been really done in the history of philosophy. I don't think it's really been done in the history of Star Trek discussion, much less on here on Trek FM. So I'm looking forward to just seeing where we go. And it feels like something that's genuinely new and novel, and that we're adding something to the discussion. And I'm hoping at the end of the day, we have a really rich library of good material to get Star Trek fans thinking a little more about philosophical issues in a more structured, rigorous way. You know, I love my Star Trek. I could geek out and talk about Star Trek things, but I can also geek out about philosophy. I just want to see what this marriage of Star Trek and philosophy really leads to. So as closing thoughts, I don't think I have anything that I haven't already said. I think, you know, we're going to see if Star Trek answers this question of free will and determinism next week when we talk about free will. Given all these different kinds of deterministic factors, is there any room at all left over for free will? What does philosophy have to say about that? And what does the Star Trek universe have to say about that? And we'll pick that up again next week. But this is really exciting. Like I said, in closing, this is, you know, creating MetaTreks has been weeks and months worth of work. You know, it's been a labor of love for me and for you and the other people behind the scenes who have been involved in getting the show off the ground. And I'm just excited to see where it goes. And I again want to invite our listeners, you know, if you have any thoughts at all on anything we've talked about tonight or we talk about next week, to find us on the Babel Conference. comments and find us on Twitter and, you know, get in touch with us and join the discussion, right? That's half the fun of talking about Star Trek and philosophy is that, you know, discussion about Star Trek will go on forever and discussion about philosophy will go on forever, right? There's a reason that philosophical issues are not a science, right? They're philosophy because they're open questions and it's not obvious at all how to go about answering them. And these are going to remain, live issues as long as humanity is around. So join the discussion. If you find any of this interesting, don't be strangers. We're easy to get a hold of and join the fun. We want to hear your perspective.
Indeed, Zachary. I think we're definitely blazing new trails. And I hope that our listeners will join us next week as we look the other side of the philosophical issue. We talk about free will and compatibilism in Star Trek. It's been a lot of fun talking about determinism in Star Trek today, but determinism isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things that you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Not interspace. Interphase. Interspace is that's the one where they shrink down and they like go and like fight viruses.
First movie I ever saw letterboxed.
Huh.
I was like, why are there black bars in the top and bottom of the screen? This movie is garbage.
Earl Grey.
Daddy, do pets have a Nexus 2?
The Pexus.
Kirk had a dog in the Nexus 2, didn't he?
Oh, Butler. Butler is now Shadow. So we have the adventures homeward bound of Butler, Porthos, and Spot. Will they make it back to their owners in Montana?
The Orb.
Well, apparently, and did you find this interesting, Matthew? Apparently, the Navark reports directly to the prophets.
Which is awkward because they don't always show up for meetings, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Plus, you never know what time the meeting is really going to be, right?
That is true. It could have been yesterday and you might have missed it.
The Ready Room.
Do you think this episode would have been so popular and remain a fan favorite if the Enterprise had been overrun with zebra mussels?
To the journey!
It's fake intimacy.
Thank you!
It is them trying to say Chakotay knows Janeway so well that just by fiddling her comm badge, he knows the crap's gonna hit the fan.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Weird is relative when you're talking about a book about a guy who taxidermies his mother, so...
The 602 Club.
I think you've hit something here, and I've never thought of it this way, but the true savior of the galaxy, it's not Obi-Wan, it's not Luke Skywalker, it's Aunt Beru.
Literary Treks.
Greg is a great guy to bring up because his dad was this raging drunk. And, he had to sort of drag him in off the porch at night because he'd come home, like, falling down drunk. And, you know, you think of, and here he was, this kind of great man for the country at the time, but he came from a place that was really kind of dark, but also very relatable.
Women at Warp.
There's always a touchstone, and this was as close to a touchstone as they ever got with Pulaski.
Plus, she banged Riker's dad.
Oh, Andy.
I'm sorry. I just think it's so funny.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep our shows coming to you each week is become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that'll design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org and find out more, and to get your seat on the mission. Zachary, do you want to tell our listeners where they can contact you?
Absolutely. I'm on Facebook in Trek FM's listener group, the Babel Conference. In fact, this is just a quick plug for the Babel Conference. If you want to talk philosophy with us, Star Trek and philosophy, anything we talked about tonight or any other philosophical issue, if there's anything at all that you want to hear us cover, we'll be sure to get it on the calendar. But find us on the Babel Conference. But you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling. And Mike, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Well, here on the network, I'm also an associate producer of Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated enterprise podcast. You can find me on Facebook as well as the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My username is at cmichael1701.
We also want to take some time to thank the many people that are involved behind the scenes with the network for helping us bring Metatrex, this new show on Star Trek and philosophy, to the network. First of all, I want to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM. You can find him as host of The Ready Room and The Orb and elsewhere on Trek FM. I want to thank our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau for their help and feedback and helping us refine this show idea and bringing this discussion to you now every week. I especially want to thank Aaron Harvey, our art director, for his fabulous work creating the Metatrex logo that you see. By the time you end up hearing this, you'll have a look at his fabulous work creating a new logo for our show. I want to thank Will Wynn, the network's content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, Dennis Costello for his fabulous work editing this show and making us sound like the best versions of ourselves. And you heard at the beginning of the show, there was a special new audio bumper from Tim Russ, Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager. Tim Russ is a fabulous gentleman, and he very kindly recorded a special audio bumper for our new show that you can hear at the beginning of the show. And Tim Russ, he's a class act. He doesn't expect any payment for his help in that regard. And on his website, which is just timrusswebpage.com/site/contact, he actually recommends that people just give a donation at any amount to one of several charities he lists on his website. He recommends the Wounded Warriors Project, a veterans care organization, the Wildlife Way Station, which is an exotic animal rescue center, and the Midnight Mission, which is a homeless shelter organization. So if you could just take a minute and visit Tim Russ's website, and if you have the means and the inclination, give a little something to one of those charities. It's just the right thing to do, and that would be a big thank you for Tim Russ in recording that special bumper for our show. We hope you enjoyed it. In fact, it made my entire year that Tim was kind enough to record that bumper for our new show. It really gives us some a class act approach to our new show. So thank you very much for that, Tim. Thank you to everyone who's helped bring Metatrex to the network. This is only episode one. We've got a long way to go, and we'll keep the acknowledgments a little shorter next week. But I wanted to make sure to thank everyone involved in helping us get where we are today to recording episode one. Thank you, everyone. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about free will and determinism tonight. We'll pick up part two of the discussion next week when we talk about free will. In the meantime, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.